Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today we have breaking news about a violent attack on Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband. Then from Public News Service, we have some more national news headlines, including threats identified from Russia and China, the Department of Justice limiting subpoenas of reporters, and Trump on the ruling end of an income tax ruling. East County Congressional candidate Stephen Houlihan is warning that democracy is at stake in his race against Daryl Issa, and we'll have details on today's show. Our newsmaker interview today is with State Senator Brian Jones, and we've previously interviewed his opponent, Joseph Rocha. And finally, with Halloween fast approaching, we'll be re-airing our bookshelf interview with Raina Menashe, the author of Spirit of Shy Moon Lake. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with a breaking news bulletin. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's 82-year-old husband, Paul Pelosi, was brutally assaulted by a hammer-wielding attacker at the couple's San Francisco home early Friday morning. Police have confirmed that the intruder shouted, "Where's Nancy?" and was looking for the speaker, not realizing that she was not in town. Paul Pelosi managed to dial 911 and kept the line open, allowing a 911 operator to hear the exchange and dispatch police. Officers arrived in time to witness the elderly Pelosi struggling with the assailant, who bashed Paul Pelosi in the head before police officers wrestled him to the ground and arrested him. The suspect, 42-year-old David DePape, has been arrested on charges of attempted murder, assault with a deadly weapon, elder abuse, and other felony crimes, CNN reports. His social media posts indicate he is a MAGA Republican and Trump supporter who promoted conspiracy theories online about the 2020 election, the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the Capitol, COVID-19, and more. Speaker Pelosi is next in line of succession for the presidency, after Vice President Kamala Harris. Nancy Pelosi and the Pelosi's five children have all flown to San Francisco to be with Paul Pelosi, who underwent 5 hours of surgery to repair a fractured skull and injuries to his right arm and hand. Fortunately, he is expected to make a full recovery, according to a statement from the Speaker's office. Locally, the attack drew bipartisan condemnation from East County's congressional representatives. Democrat Sarah Jacobs tweeted, "I'm so thankful that Paul Pelosi is safe and will make a full recovery, but this news is disturbing and unacceptable. No one, including elected officials and their families, should be the victim of violence and harassment," she said. Republican Daryl Issa posted on his Twitter account, "I'm shocked by news of the terrible attack on Paul Pelosi in his own home, hoping for a swift and full recovery."
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We have not seen anything to indicate that Putin has made a decision to use a dirty bomb, nor have we seen any indications that the Ukrainians are planning such a thing.
A new Pentagon Defense Strategy report says amid its invasion of Ukraine, Russia is a serious threat to the U.S. and its allies. But Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin notes that China remains the overall greatest security challenge as it aggressively builds up its military in the South China Sea and increases pressure on Taiwan. And the report cautions that China is trying to undermine American alliances in the Indo-Pacific region. Attorney General Merrick Garland has formally blocked the Department of Justice from using subpoenas to seize the records of journalists and government leak investigations. Temporary policies were first put in place in July 2021, amid reports that the DOJ, under then-Attorney General William Barr, had secretly sought email records of reporters critical of the Trump administration. And on the topic of leaks, Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito says the draft opinion secretly released prior to the court overturning the nationwide right to abortion was a grave betrayal of trust.
The leak also made those of us who were thought to be in the majority in support of overruling Roe and Casey targets for assassination, because it gave people a rational reason to think they could prevent that from happening by killing one of us.
A man accused of attempting to murder Justice Brett Kavanaugh is currently on trial. A federal appeals court has rejected former President Donald Trump's request to reconsider a ruling that his tax returns must be disclosed to a congressional committee. Trump could appeal to the Supreme Court. 2022 will likely be the most expensive year for federal lobbying to date. Data from Open Secrets shows that federal lobbyists raked in $3 billion through the third quarter of 2022, about $744 million shy of the $3.8 billion spent last year. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is the biggest spender. Phoenix police have made an arrest related to a break-in at a campaign office of Arizona Democratic gubernatorial candidate Katie Hobbs. A spokesperson for Hobbs blamed her Republican rival, Carrie Lake, who said the allegation is absurd.
Are you guys buying that? Are you really buying that? This just sounds like a Jussie Smollett part two. I can't believe that she would blame my amazing people or blame me for something like that.
Gun violence prevention advocates will participate in more than 200 election events this weekend across the country. Brenda Moss of El Paso, whose son was shot and killed in 2014, says guns are responsible for 110 deaths each day in the U.S.
Let's move. Let's move forward. Stop guessing. Stop debating. The time is now. Every life is important in this moment, not in the future, not in the past. They're important in this moment.
I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
During a recent Candidates to Constituents Forum in Alpine, an audience member voiced concern about the loss of voting rights in America. Stephen Houlihan, a Democrat running for Congress against Republican Daryl Issa in the 49th Congressional District, gave an impassioned response explaining exactly why our democracy is on the line in the upcoming congressional elections.
I wanted to ask you about the one thing that I'm really, really concerned about. That's the state of our democracy and the fact that we're having a lot of people that are denying that the election was fair and free are now being put into positions at register of voters across the nation. And if we do not have the ability to vote and have it be counted fairly, we do not have any of these things to talk about. So I really appreciate all of you guys coming today because it looks like it's a tough fight, but I am particularly concerned about what you think should be done on the federal level about protecting our voting rights.
Absolutely. To tell you the truth, that is the number one issue is the risk of our democracy. We are so lucky that we have the ability to vote, but also to have our votes counted. And it's so important. And you know, Daryl Issa has become an election denier. And he also voted not to even allow the votes to be counted in various states. So again, he is apparently anti-democracy, whereas I am 100% pro-democracy. My grandfather fought in World War II, went to the European scenario, and they fought, and they were anti-fascist. They were fighting against that exactly what these people now, our own representative, are trying to bring into our country. It's not okay. What happened on January 6th is not okay. And what's going on right now, as far as all these individuals getting into are going to deny the election, that is the precursors to authoritarianism. And that's what they're bringing. And so it's so important that all of us, that we are the fighters. We are in the arena. We are fighting for you. We are fighting for America. We are fighting for our democracy. And unfortunately, what's happened is, you know, the Republican Party has strayed, has gone the wrong direction. And don't get me wrong, we need two strong parties. We don't want to go too far to the right or too far to the left. We want to progress, but it can't happen when you have a conspiracy theory-led cult in charge of one of your parties. And so it is disgusting. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go there and I'm going to be willing to actually deal with it. And it's tough. It's tough. I mean, there are hate groups in this very community that we are in. There's hate groups in my hometown of Santee. I have faced it. I've seen the Nazi swastikas spray painted on the hillsides. I have seen the people wearing the KKK hoods going to the grocery stores. I have seen the people with the Nazi swastikas on their masks going to the stores with their children. They feel so emboldened. We all need to be courageous and stand up against them. It is not okay. And it can be a little bit terrifying. I've had my house vandalized by these people. I get it. I've been threatened by them. And I'm sure everyone here has had to deal with that at some point. So January 6th was absolutely a coup attempt. Our democracy is absolutely at risk. And really what we need is the freedom fighters, which right now is the Democratic Party, by the way, is you. You need to stand up. Otherwise, what's going to happen is that we're going to be going backwards in time. They're standing up against people of color, black, brown, indigenous, the LGBTQ community. They all deserve to be equal with everybody. We are all equal, regardless of race, color, creed, sexuality, none of that. We are all equal under our Constitution.
He also harshly criticized Congressman Issa, who voted against certification of the 2020 election while a violent attack was going on at the Capitol.
Darrell Issa betrayed his constitutional oath to uphold our Constitution, and I'm willing to say it. He's unfit for office, and he needs to go. So thank you.
Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And today, my very special guest is State Senator Brian Jones. He has served in the state legislature for the last 12 years, first in the Assembly, where he served as the Republican Caucus Chair, and now in the State Senate, where he's also the Republican Caucus Chair. He has a degree in business administration from San Diego State. He's worked as a government relations consultant and a church broker. He's also a former Santee City Councilman and resident of Santee, along with his wife and their three children. Now he's running for re-election, so we are here today to talk about his accomplishments in office and his goals if re-elected. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam. I appreciate that.
So why don't you start, Senator, if you could, by telling us what you consider your most significant accomplishments in the state legislature.
Great. So when that question is asked, I think a lot of times people expect the legislator to answer, you know, what legislatively in Sacramento they've done. There's actually, for me, there's two aspects to that question. What is the person doing in Sacramento representing? And then, but also what's happening in the district. And for myself, I really drive with my staff that the district operation is the most important thing that we do, because that's where government meets the road for my million constituents. And so we have a very vibrant, very active, very proactive district staff that takes care of constituent services.
Yeah, I will give a shout out to Lori on your staff who helped me with a DMV problem, and she was awesome.
Exactly. So to that point, you know, any three or four letter state agency, DMV, CARB, DOJ, EDD, any of those, the DCA, the Department of Consumer Affairs, which oversees all the licensing professions, mm-hmm. Department of Real Estate, all of those departments work for the taxpayers. That's what they're there for, to provide some kind of service to the taxpayer. And sometimes that communication breaks down. So, for example, during the pandemic, when the government shut down the businesses and people couldn't go to work and their businesses couldn't open, one of the things that government needed to do was make that right. And one of the ways that government makes that right is through the Unemployment Insurance Fund, through the EDD, Employment Development Department. Well, immediately after the pandemic shutdown, EDD was not answering their phone. You couldn't get there to respond to an email, and their website wasn't working. So my district staff helped 2,500 families in that 24 months. They couldn't get their unemployment insurance. And Miriam, some of these families, the state owed them back pay of $20,000.
Yeah, that's a lot. That can mean the difference between, you know, losing your house or having your car repossessed or something. So that's important.
Those are both accurate examples of what was about to happen. So we had several people say, I was about ready to pack up my apartment and just move out of state because I had nowhere else to go. And then they finally learned somehow that they could call their state legislator and we can make things happen for them.
Good for you. You know, it's often difficult, I know, to get legislation signed into law when you're a member of the minority party, whether that's Republicans in Sacramento right now or say, you know, Democrats when Trump had control of Congress. But you somehow managed to get quite a few of your bills enacted and signed into law. So I wanted to give you a chance to share a few of the most significant ones that, you know, that have been enacted.
Well, this year, 9 of my bills have made it to the governor's desk. He's signed 3 of them. He's unfortunately vetoed 1. Mm-hmm. So we've got 5 to go. So he signed SB 1421. He has signed. Basically
what they do or what those were about.
So 1421 is the one that deals with it's the one he signed yesterday as part of his housing and homeless package. Mm-hmm. It deals with the homeless commission up in Sacramento. As you know, and your viewers and readers know that a big part of the homeless community are developmentally disabled folks that they really don't have a voice in government. And we've been working on this issues. I'm part of the Disability Access Commission for California. And so my bill will assign on one of these commissions a former homeless with a developmental disability will have a seat at the table on one of these commissions to add that voice and that perspective as the state is dealing with the homeless issues.
Very good. Now, did your catalytic converter bill get signed into law?
Unfortunately, my catalytic converter bill died, but there were eight other catalytic converter bills. 2 of them made it through the process. I co-authored both of those, I think one he signed into law earlier this week.
That's good to help cut down on catalytic converter theft.
I'll get you an update on the catalytic converter legislation.
That sounds good. What other ones of yours have made it into law or do you think are likely to get signed that are sitting there waiting on a decision by the governor right now?
I did a licensing reform bill for professional engineers, land surveyors, and geologists. He signed that one. Mm-hmm. I did a bill for fiduciary continuation for seniors, persons with disabilities, and children when they have a fiduciary and it's a very nuanced thing. But anyways, if they're fiduciary, it becomes incapacitated for something that the courts can automatically assign a new one. I had a bill earlier in the year that he signed that helps foster kids with their health care needs. Mm-hmm. And earlier in the year, also a bill that helps with business owners by streamlining some of their bureaucratic paperwork. And so you'll notice I serve on the Human Services Committee. So some of my bills this year were a result of that and being on that commission as well. And then a lot of stuff is small business oriented.
Super. Your opponent is Joseph Rocha, and he has been critical of your stances on a couple of issues, Brian. I want to give you a chance to just respond. One of them is climate change. In the past, you voiced skepticism over climate change, and recently you voted against the California Climate Crisis Act. I wonder if you could clarify whether your views on climate change have evolved at all as there's more information coming out. And what, if anything, would you support to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions? And we want to address the bill specifically and what your issues were with it. That would be great, too.
Sure. That particular bill, I don't remember the specific aspects of it. I can certainly I have notes on it somewhere and can get back to it. My skepticism is based on government's response to climate change. And we're living through right now one of the most historic droughts in our history.
We are.
With Lake Mead and Lake Powell being at a historic and dangerous lows. So we know that the climate change, we know the climate is changing. This year, in response to that, look, I'm looking at legislation that actually solves problems and doesn't necessarily give government more unchecked power. That's really my concern on my skepticism with the climate change stuff. So for example, this year, I was the only Republican in the Senate to vote for SB 54, which was the plastic pollutions bill, was championed by Senator Allen from LA.
Yeah.
And I've toured, I've traveled around the world. I've been in the oceans. I've seen the plastic pollution that's ending up in the oceans. And we need to start doing something about that. We needed to start doing something about it a long time ago. So that is one idea this year, a big idea, Miriam, actually, that I looked at and said, I can get behind this and champion this with Senator Allen. And I was the only Republican that voted for it.
Yeah. So it's nice to, I think people like sometimes to see people, elected officials, looking at the idea and not just whether it came from somebody with a D or an R after their name. There's been so much of that partisan divide and on so many things.
One of the things you started this question with was getting stuff done and being in the minority party. I will let you know that the frustration is bipartisan. Actually, my Democrat colleagues don't get all of their ideas through the
legislature. That's true. They don't. Sometimes the governor vetoes theirs too.
So. Exactly right. So they get to be as frustrated as me at times.
True. That's true. The other big difference in views, I guess, that your opponent has talked about quite a bit is reproductive rights, which is an issue. It's become a lot more significant, I think, for a lot of women nationwide since the Supreme Court voted to overturn Roe versus Wade and basically allowed states to restrict or ban abortion access. Mr. Rocha is pro-choice. Brian, you have a 100% rating from pro-life groups, 0% from Planned Parenthood, and have recently voted against bills that would protect or expand abortion access for women in California or those coming maybe from other states now to try to get them. So I wanted to ask what you would say to women who might be facing, unwanted pregnancies or concerned about women or girls who might be rape victims, incest victims, or have pregnancies that put their lives or their health in danger. Are there any circumstances, where you would support a woman's ability to access abortion?
Well, Miriam, I've always been open about my pro-life position, and I'm not suddenly going to change that just because the politics of that issue have changed nationwide. And I think here in California, the women that and young women that you just mentioned, really in California, the bottom line is, Miriam, the governor and the Democrats in charge in Sacramento, they can't run on their track record this year. We've got soaring inflation. We've got out of control crime on the rise in California, homelessness, and our education system is failing in California. So this is going to be a distraction, I think, in California that the governor has to put out there as a major platform for himself to try to get their base to turn out, because he can't run on his record. And his colleagues can't run on their record. And I've always been clear on my position on this. The good news about this year, the governor and the attorney general have both already said that the U.S. Supreme Court ruling makes no difference in California, that abortion rights in California are protected. They're going to continue to be protected. And in addition to that, voters this year actually get to go to the polls and say for themselves on what their stance is on the life
issue. There's a constitutional amendment that could take it ultimately out of the hands even of the legislature.
I think that's where we're at on that issue. And I'm focused on fixing California and what's wrong with California.
That was my next question. Your website says you're running to fix California and keep Californians safe, or running for re-election, I should say. I wondered if you could specifically address your ideas for reducing crime, especially keeping sex offenders from being placed in East County. We've seen that happen sometimes without even notice in Lakeside, and to try to also with the worst of the worst, the sexually violent predators, those with that designation, how to prevent a disproportionate share from being placed in East County. And I know you had a bill that didn't make it through on that, but are there any other ideas for addressing that might, have a chance to make it through?
Well, Miriam, first of all, I have to compliment you and your team on those issues, because you guys have been doing a great job of covering it, but also I think more importantly, not just covering it, but being responsive to the public and the private citizens that it affects the most. You've really shown a compassion towards those people, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. I think nobody wants someone who's done that to be living next door to them. The problem is, what do you do with them? I guess
you think that would be common sense, that would be okay. Let's check the box on this, solve it, and move on. But as you watched with my bill this year, trying to move it through the legislature that would have actually made some legitimate positive reforms, especially in the sexually violent predator aspect of
it. Yeah, and as I recall, I think what it would have done was said you can't put more than a certain percentage of them in any one supervisor's district. So if they're going to let them out, they'd have to at least be evenly distributed among so that everybody gets some of them, you know?
Yes, that was, yeah, that was part of the original concept. And then we kind of, you know, amended it a little bit to, you know, two things that I think it did, four things, but the two things I think were most impactful was, number one, it required the governor's administration to be accountable to where these sexually violent predators end up. Currently, the way the situation works, the director of state hospitals, once these sexually violent predators are released to Liberty Healthcare, they no longer pay attention to where they're going. So my bill would have required that the director of state hospitals sign off on the placement. That way, we know that the governor knows where they are. Now, he may not know personally, but at least his director would know. And the second thing it would do, it was would require the state to first find a place on state property that would be more appropriate for them to be housed. So,
example, yeah, I know Diane Jacob used to say that. Put them on trailers at the state prison sites or something, I guess.
Governors did it. Duke-Najian did it. Wilson did it. And Schwarzenegger did it. So it's been done. There's precedent. Possible. We could do it again.
Yeah. Okay.
I will be fighting for that issue for my constituents and really, Miriam, all of San Diego County.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say people statewide, really, because I'm sure we're not the only county that has the issue. There is an issue that I haven't seen talked about, but it should be of concern. And that is that the El Capitan Dam in Lakeside, which is in your district, has been rated by the state in the worst, most dangerous condition. It also has been rated as having the highest possible risk of loss of life if it were to break. And we've seen at one point when I first researched this, there were three dams that were bad like that. And the other two, there's been some money put forward to at least partially fix them. But I haven't seen that happen for the El Capitan Dam yet. Is there any effort being made to bring funds to the district, maybe ask the feds for some of that infrastructure money or whatever, but to make this safe, especially now that we're hearing the latest predictions of climate change, if they turn out to be true, or that we're going to see the next phase here, it could be more and worse storms in California. So while they always said, oh, we don't really think it's ever going to fill and break, you know, the consequences of it does are devastating. You know, you've got the new stadium in the path of this thing.
Well, not just, I mean, there's a lot between El Cap and the stadium.
Well, I mean, the El Mountain Valley and you name it. Yeah.
So I don't know if you saw earlier in the year, I did an article with, I believe, AP, and then they were doing a statewide story, but I met the reporter out at Lake Jennings, and we did a story, and we talked about El Cap
specifically. I missed that. It may have been when I was out of the country or dealing. I had a death in my immediate family in April, so I apologize if I missed that one.
I have somebody send it to you. I don't remember the reporter's name, but he did a really good job. And mm-hmm. you brought up El Cap, and we talked about El Cap. We also talked about Lake Morena and mm-hmm. Loveland and Barrett. Mm-hmm. And really, there's some precedent here in San Diego that the San Diego County Water Authority has done a great job with their reservoirs. El Cap, belongs to the city of San Diego. Mm-hmm. And you kind of hit the nail on the head. It if it was at full capacity, it would be. And that's the problem, is now they're having to keep it under 50% capacity. We're in the middle of a drought. We need
the water storage too. Yeah.
We need to retrofit these reservoirs so we can get them back to full capacity.
Yeah. And it's actually very near an active earthquake fault. I looked through historical documents and, you know, you once had an Indian village there and the homes were flattened by an earthquake. So it's possible.
Right. So that is one of the things that's on kind of my long-term perspective, is advocating for this water infrastructure, working with the County Water Authority, because they have done a good job. You know, they raised San Vicente. I think that tripled the volume. I don't remember the exact number, but I thought it tripled.
Yeah, it was the largest dam raise in the nation. I remember that much. Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then you remember they built new infrastructure tunnels from San Vicente to the aqueduct so that they could move water from Olivenhain, Lake Hodges to San Vicente back and forth. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be able to do more of that. And we need to retrofit these reservoirs so that we can increase our capacity here in San Diego County and continue doing a good job for mm-hmm. our constituents here.
Yeah, hopefully also make them safer.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I'm sure you know, in addition to San Vicente, San Diego County Water Authority signed historical agreements with farmers in the Imperial Valley to buy water from them.
Yeah.
Without fallowing their land, and then also relined the American Canal so that, you know, we were losing a lot of water through seepage there, and the San Diego County Water Authority has fixed that. So San Diego's done a great job on the waterfront. We need to do.
They have. They've got the pure water thing now too, where they're doing the water recycling. So they're kind of doing.
I don't say
everything they can, but an awful lot more than any other places.
Right. And I don't know if you've been out to Santee Lakes in the last couple of months, but they're in full construction mode out there. They're moving dirt and.
Oh, what are they building?
The pure water.
Oh, the pure water. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I've had Mike, one of our reporters, has been out covering that, but I haven't personally been out there in a while. Yeah,
they're moving full speed ahead.
Very good. Senator, what else would you like our audience to know that I haven't specifically asked you about here?
Well, let's see, we covered constituent services in the district. We covered being able to get legislation done in Sacramento from the minority party.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, one of the things we talked briefly about me being with the governor yesterday in San Francisco. And I think.
Yeah. What was that all about? That was
your listeners and your viewers is, you know, I'm doing my very best, even as a Republican in the minority party, to reach across the aisle mm-hmm. and be as effective as I can and work in a bipartisan manner, so that I can give the best representation that I can to my constituents in San Diego County. So the governor signed two housing bills yesterday in a public press conference.
What will they do?
They are both, I'll have to get you the details on this, because they kind of are, one is SB6 mm-hmm. by Caballero, and one is AB 2011 by Buffy, Assemblymember Buffy Wicks. They both deal with housing and rezoning commercial property and allowing for more houses to be built in commercial zones and areas that were previously underutilized and have because of online purchasing and the change in retail habits.
Yeah, good idea.
We want to get as much housing units built in California as possible. And this was historic. I was the only Republican at the press conference with 10 to 15 of my Democrat colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're moving the ball in the right direction. And it takes both Democrats and Republicans working together. And as the caucus chair for the Senate Republicans, it's my job to find ways that we can work with the governor and the majority party mm-hmm. to do positive things for all of Californians. And that's what I will continue to work on.
Very good. Let's talk a little bit more about homelessness, too, which when we ask the public, they're regularly naming that as one of their biggest concerns. I know you've had a measure or two that you've introduced at the state level to address that. And I'm wondering if you could tell us briefly about the bill you've introduced. And beyond, you know, the issue of sort of cleaning up the streets and limiting where, you know, where camps can be to keep the public safe. I wanted to also ask about your feelings on what should be done to get help for homeless folks, you know, that are in need, and or prevent them from becoming homeless to begin with, which it sounds like maybe more housing may help with, but if it's affordable. But,
you know, Miriam, I don't know if you've recently talked to a mom or a dad or a sister or brother of somebody who's homeless.
Yeah.
And one of their frustrations, the number one frustration I hear from people in that situation is we've run out of options and the government won't help us. And then they follow that up with, my brother or my son needs to be compelled to get help. As long as we let them do whatever, they're not in a mindset to be able to make rational decisions for themselves.
So the governor, it sounds like the governor was his care court idea that I guess just got pushed through, it'll roll out next year, would allow local jurisdictions to compel somebody to go into, especially for mental health services.
Yes, exactly. So that's where I was going on this. You know, in homelessness, the biggest part of homelessness right now, Miriam, are, you know, certainly there's people that are down on their luck and
run
some financial difficulties. That's certainly part of the homeless community. But right now in San Diego County, especially, there's many resources available for people that want, that are know where they are, how they got there, and they know they need help to get out. And San Diego is doing a great job through the county, through the nonprofits that are available for that, doing that. But a lot of the people right now are in a mental health state, either because of drug addiction or mental illness, or, you know, some other mental capacity that they've been in this situation too long, and they're at a point in life where they're just not capable of making a rational decision for themselves. So I supported the CARE Court. I think that's a step in the right. It's a small step, Miriam, but it's a step in the right direction. My bill that I introduced last year to prohibit homeless encampments near sensitive community areas like schools, parks, libraries, and daycare centers, that's a small step in the right direction. Yeah. We didn't get here overnight. I think we can get out of this jam faster than we got into it, but it's going to take all 120 of us in the legislature plus the governor working together to come up with as many good ideas. There's not one solution. And I think what we've been locked into for the last 5 years of this debate is somebody wants one solution. Well, there isn't one.
Yeah, exactly. There's we find a lot, even when we go out sometimes, and I've had my reporters lately talking to some of the homeless people, and I'm still learning things I'm surprised at. I was surprised to find, for example, that if a couple is homeless, but they don't have kids, sometimes the shelters won't take them, especially if they're unmarried or they're a gay couple, because a lot of the ones are either faith-based or priority is given to either single people or people that have children. And yet there's a lot of couples, even some that, you know, lost everything in that fire a couple weeks ago in Santee. So yeah, it just seems like maybe more research into what are the things that are preventing people who aren't addicts or whatever, but what are the things that are preventing somebody who maybe wants to get into a shelter and get help from being able to find that, you know?
I think what I'm starting to see with myself is and my colleagues in the legislature is, you know, many of us, when we get elected to the legislature, we have our own brilliant best idea, right? And or we have our own background that colors our perspective moving forward. And we've gotten to the point to the ideas that we've had and the ideas that we need to have may or may not be the same thing. And we've got to set aside our backgrounds and histories a little bit and come and get in a room together and start talking about new ideas that will move us in a positive direction on this. And I think there's lots of opportunity, Miriam, for a bipartisan solution on this. I'm going to keep pushing it. The Republicans in the legislature introduced a package of bills earlier in the year called the ACT program, ACT, which was accountability, compassion, and treatment. I believe that those three things are a big part of helping people get themselves out of homelessness. But maybe there's two more letters that we haven't considered that needed to be a part of the equation as well. So I'm not locked into just what we introduced. I'm open to what other, if all 119 of my colleagues came to the legislature in December, each with one good idea for dealing with homelessness, we could probably use all 120 ideas.
It's a huge problem out there. Senator, I wanted to give you a chance to tell us what endorsements you have that you're most proud of, and also where can people find more information about you? And folks, if you tuned in late, we're speaking with Senator Brian Jones about his reelection campaign.
Well, my website is electbrianjones.com. Pretty easy. It's been the same for the last 12 years. So electbrianjones.com. We're having some technical issues. I guess nowadays on our whatever's going on, you got to put www in front of it. I thought we'd all grown past that, but www.electbrianjones.com. And look, my endorsements are what I'm most proud about them is they're broad ranging. So I'm endorsed by many of our local elected officials, mayors, council members, water board members. I'm endorsed by NFIB, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which is a small business organization. Mm-hmm.
East County Chamber, saw that one come in.
East County Chamber, I've got that one. Cal Fire, California Professional Firefighters, PORAC, the Police Officer Research Committee in Sacramento, San Diego Police Officers Association, El Cajon Police Officers Association, San Diego Deputy Sheriff's Association. So I've got law enforcement and firefighters, first responders that know that I'm working in a bipartisan manner in Sacramento to provide the very best paying benefits for them, but then also to make sure that they're equipped and ready to handle the emergencies that show up in our communities. For example, we've expanded the number of helicopters in San Diego County, firefighting helicopters and police helicopters. I co-authored a bill with Mike McGuire from, I think he's in the 3rd Senate District up on the North Coast in California, to expand the number of CAL FIRE firefighters by 1,100. Wow. Unfortunately, that's back to the original question, being frustrated.
Yeah.
The bill was held in committee, but he and I are going to continue working on it and getting it.
They're definitely overworked. We've been seeing stories come out about high rate of PTSD now in the wildland firefighters and, you know, suicides and things like that, because they're being asked to just go away for months at a time, right, as the fires get bigger and worse. So good to see efforts to address that.
And I think it's incumbent upon all of us to show our appreciation to all of our first responders, firefighters and police. And, you know, police especially over the last couple of years have really come under a lot of pressure for national things, mm-hmm, that really aren't part of the California conversation when it comes with our post-certified police officers. Our police officers in California have the best training nationwide. And there's no comparison to the training our police officers get to what other states do. And we have the best, and we need to show them that we appreciate them.
Very good. Well, Brian, I really want to take the time to thank you for joining us today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. I'll let you have the last word today. Is there anything else that you want to add that we didn't ask you about?
Miriam, thank you. You know, as you and I have had a good working relationship for a while, even since the first time you got to go to a committee hearing with me in Sacramento and live a day in my life. Also sharing
that's
with the
right. With that's the, right. A media related bill that was up. Right. Yeah, that was great.
It died right in front of our eyes. And we were both very surprised that was going to happen. So I've
tried. Yeah, you tried.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to representing the district, this San Diego County, for 4 more years in Sacramento, and doing the very best job that we've been doing and continue to do. So thank you for your attention and your help. I appreciate
You're welcome. It. Well, we will have this interview posted on our website soon at eastcountymagazine.org, probably Monday or so. We also have an interview with the other candidate in the race. So, Brian, I want to just thank you again for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment.
This is Miriam Raftery, host of the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And today I'm also guest hosting Bookshelf, because my guest today is Raina Menashe, our host of Bookshelf. Raina's fiction has been honored by organizations such as the San Diego Writers and Editors Guild, San Diego Book and Writing Awards, and the Southern California Writers Conference. Her first novel, Twice Begun, and her second novel, Silent Bird, were both finalists in the 2012 and 2013 San Diego Book Awards. And her newest novel, a paranormal suspense titled The Spirit of Shy Moon Lake, was released in spring 2021. Her website, RainaMenashe.com, includes blogs on psychology and wellness, writing, and other social commentary. Also a licensed clinical social worker, Raina Menashe has taught psychology and counseling at Southern California universities, as well as therapeutic techniques to human service professionals. In addition, she's a workshop leader at the Southern California Writers Conference in San Diego and Irvine. She created a class called Character Therapy and You're the Shrink. I love that. And it's alive to emphasize the joyful creativity of exploring therapeutic exercises with a fictional character. Raina has served as vice president of the Kronos Theater Group, and she often uses dramatic as well as therapeutic techniques in her creative work. And of course, as host of our Bookshelf right here on East County Magazine's radio show in San Diego, Raina interviews local authors and sometimes national ones about their creative processes. And you can find more about her at her website, RainaMenashe.com, and that's spelled RainaMenashe.com. Raina, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam. It's so much fun to be on my own show.
Yeah, it's different, isn't it? Being the interviewee instead of the interviewer.
It feels a little strange.
Yeah. I've got to ask, switching from prior genres, and you're really noted for crossing genres in your books that really defy definition. How difficult was it to switch from psychological romance novels that dealt with some heavy subjects such as addiction and recovering from different traumas into writing paranormal suspense?
Well, in some ways, I see it as consistent because in a way, the suspense book really has a lot to do with trauma. And the stories that we tell to comfort ourselves, to soothe ourselves after a trauma, the different paths we choose or don't choose, how we heal or don't heal. I'm always doing this psychological thing, but I put it in a different kind of story. I think I've always wanted to write something scary. Scary in the more paranormal sense. And I've been hinting in that direction. And so I decided to just kind of plunge in and do it. And it was very different writing this book.
Well, I've read Spirit of Shy Moon Lake. I enjoyed it, even though it did keep me up all night. It is a page.
Oh, yay.
So you did your job. Yeah. Where did you dream up your ideas for this creative book, Raina, in which people are drawn to this beautiful, but perilous Shy Moon Lake and the secrets from the past that it holds?
And it started with an idea. What if you were in a place where your karma, so to speak, what you sow, you know, what you reap, you sow, comes back at you really quickly, where you get what you deserve or you don't get what you don't deserve, or at least people think that's what happens. And then I sort of, you know, it just meanders off. I mean, this book took about a decade to write. And in that process, it changed quite a bit. But it had a lot to do with what people believe again, what they tell themselves, how we often don't know what's true, what's not true.
Interesting. What was the inspiration for your main character, Jess McCourtney, and for that matter, any of the other key characters that are so compelling in this book, Raina?
Well, you know, sometimes people have always asked me that, especially, well, in my former books as well. And sometimes they think it's me because I often write in the first person.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're all like bits and pieces of me. It's like one big salad or a collage. I think Jess has parts of me for sure. Raising a small boy, the pains, traumas, and incredible joys of motherhood are in there. What it's like to experience betrayal is in there. You know, these are things that everyone experiences, or not everyone, but many people experience. The main character, Charlie McCourtney, her husband, he's a poet. And I think I explored a lot about artists there. Again, what they tell themselves, the stories they tell themselves, how they comfort themselves, how they cope with life's dilemmas and mistakes. Now, the other sort of the residents of the town, I really just had plain romping fun with that. I wanted to make them superstitious, but I wanted to create superstitions and beliefs that don't currently exist. I didn't want to trot on anyone's beliefs or, you know, traditions. I just sort of made up my own. So the whole thing is imagination from beginning to end. But again, why do people believe what they believe?
Who knows? Yeah, fascinating psychological angles in this. So you actually finished writing and marketing the book in the middle of a global pandemic and lockdown. How challenging was that? Or maybe it was the opposite. Maybe you found you had a lot of time on your hands all of a sudden.
Well, I had already written it and I had done most of the editing, final editing, for a long time, actually. And what the pandemic did is when it started, it just kind of took the oomph out of me. I had two book launches, two or three that I canceled because I didn't want to do them virtually. Virtual launchings are fine. It's just that I wanted to read this aloud, you know, live.
So you were saying it just sort of took the oomph out of things. In what ways?
I had all this excited preparation that I had to change. So there were live book launches that I had to cancel. And also, I have to say, I got a little depressed, like lots of people, you know, with the shutdown.
Sure.
And I guess it took a lot of, it took me longer. It took me longer. I just kind of sat on it for several months. So and then it inspired, of course, other books because you're thinking pandemic themes.
Oh my gosh. Let's talk about finding the silver lining there.
Right? Yeah, not that anyone wants to hear about a pandemic right now.
Did you try any virtual events?
I did. I've gotten used to it. I think we go kicking and screaming into things that we're not used to. I'm a clinician, as you know, in my day job, and I do those meetings virtually.
As we're doing this interview via Zoom right now.
Exactly. So I think now I would do a virtual book launch, but at the time I was still, I wanted to do things live. Yeah. So it was disappointing in that way, but you do end up saving some money during a pandemic if you're still employed. And so use some of those things to revamp my website. You know, as I said, make lemons out of lemonade if you can.
There you go. Raina, can you read an excerpt for us from The Spirit of Shy Moon Lake?
Sure, I would love to. I'm going to take an excerpt that's fairly early on. It's page 23 in the book. And I'll begin where the little boy Jonah, they just moved to Shy Moon Lake, the family, that's Jess, her husband Charlie, and Jonah. And the little boy Jonah was climbing on the balcony right away the second they got to their new house and almost fell and hurt himself. And so the mother is shaken up. This is the scene right afterwards. Mommy, are you mad at me? No, you just scared me, honey. I'm fine now. Sorry I raised my voice. He thought about that and smiled. Yeah, he would forgive me. Big of him. Then he stood on his tippy toes, peering towards the lake. Who's that? Who's who? He pointed. There, in the water. I squinted at the inky blackness, recalling the town legend about long ago lovers drowning. Sorry, honey, it's too dark. You're just seeing tree shadows. There were indeed tree shadows, thrown by starlight, shifting across the dark water like a flutter of insects. Silhouettes of trees appeared suspended between opposing diadems of light. The Milky Way above and its reflection on the waters of Shy Moon Lake below. How thrilling, I thought, to view a night sky containing more than 6 or 7 stars. Against this luminous scintillating dome, anything seemed possible. Like, I wondered, what would happen to all this beauty if there was an earthquake? Violent quakes had no doubt accompanied the birth of the volcano that now cupped the lake. How many points on the Richter scale could these cottages endure before windows shattered, porches toppled, the land crumbling beneath our feet? Maybe we will need to climb inside that refrigerator. Mrs. Paddock said, Mrs. McCourtney, are you all right? I shook off the unwanted gloom. I might not be as congenitally cheerful as my husband, but I was not usually like this either. Yes, thank you. I'm fine. I'm just tired. It's been a long day. As Charlie rose back up the steps, the upper half of his body hidden behind boxes and bags, a door slammed. A porch light flicked on in the cottage next door. We looked over. A woman with short, darkish hair gazed back at us, her expression flash frozen. Good evening, I called, waving, happy for the distraction. We're moving in. She did not reply, just stared. She had to have heard me. The cottages were not that far apart. I stepped to the end of the porch. My name is Jess. This is my husband, Charlie, and our son, Jonah. We've bought this place and we're moving in right now. Still no response from the lady next door. Was she ill? Disabled? Finally, as if set to a delayed timer, her eyebrows went down and a smile opened up nice and big. Well, hello. Welcome.
What a marvelous and somewhat chilling piece of foreshadowing that is.
Thank you.
Love it. I've got to ask you about your class, Character Therapy and You're the Shrink, emphasizing as we've noted, the joyful creativity of exploring therapeutic exercises with a fictional character. Can you tell us a little bit more about that for people who may be interested?
Yes, this class is really personal. It's like an art project for me. When I was little, I couldn't decide between being a writer and being, say, a psychologist. So basically, I kept going back and forth between the two of them. This class is really putting it all together. I take all these psychological theories that I learned in my master's degree in my profession and look at a character from all these theories, the child development theories. Where did your character get stuck in developmental tasks that causes current behavior? Or looking at defense mechanisms and thought distortions and sort of really looking into these explanations that we've developed to understand your character better if you choose to. Now, do I do that with my characters? I think I do it more on an informal level, but I also hand out to the people who attend the class, I hand out lots of worksheets so that they can revisit these theories and play with them. Play with your characters. Have fun. This is the sandbox.
Very wise advice. The characters are really what drives a novel, I think, even more than plot. So that begs the question of what are you working on next?
Well, Twice Begun, which was my first novel, has to do about with sort of reinventing yourself after, you know, a huge betrayal, and how sometimes the people that we think are better people don't turn out to be as good as people who have been through very hard times and have risen above. There is a house in that book, it's her great aunt's house in Coronado, that was a home for hysterical women during World War II. And a lot of readers said, man, I wanted to learn more about that house. And when are you going to write the sequel to the book? I want to know what happens to this former social worker who gets involved with a person who's a recovering addict or former client, which is taboo. Anyway, so yeah. I decided to write this sequel and prequel. Ah. So it goes into the great aunt's youth in this house, as well as, so that's called Thrice Begun. I'm about, you know, halfway, maybe three quarters of the way through that. And then there's a children's story called The House That Sneezed that is really four drawings. I'm not doing the drawings, but it's very near completion. So that one also has psychological themes, basically to help little kids deal with grief by using a metaphor of the house that's not feeling well.
And very timely right now with a pandemic that's killed 700,000 Americans as we speak.
I could say that that book was inspired by when I worked with little kids and families, and I was looking for that book to use with the children that I worked with, and I couldn't find it. So I finally said, okay, well, let's create it.
So it's really filling an important need. Well, Raina, you're just so versatile, and I want to thank you today. We are out of time, but I want to thank you for coming on the show today and sharing all of your marvelous literary knowledge with us. Readers, you can find more about Raina Menashe and her books at rainamenashe.com, and that's spelled RainaMenashe.com.
It was a pleasure, Miriam. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. You've been listening to the Bookshelf segment on East County Magazine's radio show on KNSJ, bringing you news about local literary luminaries and some great books to read. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.